Up next this hour, the science of Evo Devo. Birds do it, bees do it, we do it. Turns out we all do it in a similar way. I'm talking about development. For years, scientists knew very little about the process of development. They knew how it started with the meeting of sperm and egg. But how that one fertilized egg grew into a million-celled or trillion-celled organism was somewhat of a mystery. The black box of biology, so to speak. Well, new technologies developed in the last 20 years or so have allowed scientists to see what's happening in that black box. And they found that development in wildly different organisms is remarkably similar. By looking at the relatively small number of genes that control development, biologists say they can learn a lot about evolution. This new branch of biology even has the catchy title, which I've been using because I like to say it, Evo Devo, for evolutionary developmental biology. And joining me now to talk more about it is my guest, Sean B. Carroll. He's an investigator with the Howard Hughes Medical Institute and a professor of molecular biology at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He's the author of Endless Forms Most Beautiful, The New Science of Evo Devo, published by W.W. Norton last year. Thanks for talking with me today, Dr. Carroll.
Thanks for having me, Joe.
So start me off. Did I kind of get it right about what Evo Devo is?
Yeah, you were right on the button.
Okay. Well, we can stop then. Thanks very much. No. I mean, what's going on here? Why is this a new field of endeavor?
Well, as you mentioned, in the last 20 years, we finally got a peek inside the black box of embryos. And I guess let me start maybe with an analogy. If you consider the construction of a building, what would it look like to us if we didn't see the workers and the machinery putting that together? It would look as though the building assembled itself or was put there by some magical force. Now that we can see the workers and the machinery, now we understand how things are put together. And now that we understand how the making of an individual building, some particular species, we understand how differences in the way those workers and machinery put things together give you the different kinds of buildings that we see. In this case, the different kinds of buildings that are different kinds of animals we see in the animal kingdom.
Ah. Now, I meant to invite our listeners to join this conversation. The number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. So, okay. So you talk about a molecular toolkit for building. I mean, what exactly are we talking about there?
Well, a small fraction of all the genes we have, or any other animal has, are really devoted to organ building and body building, with the rest of the genes really carrying out basic physiological tasks like getting nutrients in and flushing things out, or the specialized jobs of the types of cells we have, like those for carrying oxygen or for fighting off invaders and things like this. But the building, the putting your backbone in place, deciding the number of vertebrae, the number of ribs, where the hands are going to go, how many digits, where the eyes go, how many there will be, the color of fur or skin or scales or feathers. These are the toolkit genes. They are shaping the size, the number, and the color of bodies and body parts.
So if this idea that there's a relatively small toolkit that builds everything up from the same sort of set of principles, if that's the new idea, what did people used to think?
They used to think that really there was an entirely different genetic recipe for different forms of organisms. It was an intuitive bias that we just didn't see the connection between, say, something like a tiny fruit fly and a magnificent human. Our expectations were that there would be entirely different rules and entirely different materials being used in assembling the bodies of these different animals.
So how does this idea square with, you know, what Darwin was talking about how different species evolve?
Well, Darwin and many of his followers understood the importance of embryology to understanding evolution. But it was, as you said, a black box for really more than a century. So while everyone could agree that what was going on in embryos was important, and Darwin felt that embryology was the best evidence in support of the evolution of forms, understanding that changes in development lead to changes in form. They knew that at a conceptual level, but they didn't have any material understanding of it whatsoever.
Mm-hmm. So, but this is the part that I always find I get a little confused at when I hear a description about something changing in the way we look at it. So, okay, so if things didn't evolve independently, but then these developmental genes have been sort of conserved all along from very simple organisms to more complex ones, you still have to have something that says, okay, what's controlling the toolkit to come up with the different forms?
Exactly, the operating instructions.
Right.
And so what we were expecting was that the genes themselves were changing. And we've been looking at genes in the genetic code for 40 years. And the expectation was that sort of the inventory of tools used for building different animals would be different. But really, what makes animals different, what makes us different from apes and apes different from other mammals, et cetera, is how the toolkit is used. Those operating instructions are also encoded in DNA, but they've been in a part of the DNA that we haven't spent much time. It is much harder to decode and decipher, and this is really one of the current problems in biology, is deciphering what I refer to as the dark matter of the genome, the parts that have been harder to see but really have wired in there the instructions for how the toolkit is used.
Right. And so it seems as if, since this, what you call dark matter, has been a relatively new object of attention in the genetic world, and in fact, we don't really know very much about the control mechanisms yet.
No, we don't. I don't want to say that we're, you know, lost. It's simply, it's much harder to study, and we learn about it sort of piece by piece. The great thing about the genetic code is that we can read the genetic code of anything from a bacteria to a whale. It's the same code across all of the kingdom, all kingdoms. But the code for building bodies and how that's wired in is unique to each species. And so deciphering that code is a much tougher informational problem.
Mm-hmm. Okay, why don't we let our listeners join in on this, because I find it an interesting concept, and I wonder, well, before I ask, I mean, is it gaining wide acceptance? Does everybody say, oh yes, of course, this has got to be it, or are there still people who say, no, this Evo Devo is a fad and it's going to pass away?
Well, there may be people who think it's a fad. I think everyone appreciated, first of all, understanding development was a huge quest for biology, and it has great importance, for example, in the medical arena. So there's been tremendous solid progress in understanding the bodybuilding and organ-building genes of everything from, as I said, fruit flies to humans. Now, in terms of evolution, it's a really simple connection. Remodeling development is what gives you the evolution of form. So if you want to understand diversity of form, you have to understand how development changes. So Evo Devo is here to stay. Understanding those subtle changes that take place in development that give us big brains or allow our posture to be upright or put our thumb where it is, these are things we're really going to want to understand.
Okay, let's invite the listeners into the conversation. Our number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And why don't we try Chris in DeKalb, Illinois. Chris, welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, Ira.
Well, it's somebody like Ira. It's Joe Palka today.
Oh, I'm sorry.
It's okay.
My question is, okay, in college in the early 90s when I was taking biology, we were taught this saying, ontogeny recapitulates phylogeny, which basically means that human embryos and higher mammal embryos go through stages which resemble the stages of evolution. There's one point where the embryo has something that looks like fish gills. There's another point where it looks very much like a chicken embryo. And so, you know, they were saying that we kind of retrace the steps of evolution as we develop as embryos. And then I heard later that that had been totally disproven and they really weren't gill slits after all. So I wanted to see what Evo Devo has to say about that debate.
Cool question.
Great question. Well, Evo Devo gives us whole new ways of testing questions like that, because we have new ways of seeing the events that go on in embryos and asking, well, are there repertoires of genes that are being used that we know, for example, are used in fish in a particular way? How are they used in a mammal, for example? And the reason why ontogeny recapitulates phylogeny has been, it's such a catchy phrase, but there's a lot of sort of extra jeopardy words in there.
Mm-hmm.
But the reason why it has lost favor is we understand that evolution chucks all sorts of pieces of the developmental program, and that it's not a strict recapitulation of evolutionary history at all. There's whole parts of development that are missing when one compares organisms, because as organisms change lifestyles and adapt to new habitats and, for example, come to land versus water, things become dispensable and some things do disappear. The other part of development that evolves a great deal are the very earliest steps in, for example, the making of eggs and the early events in an egg. That's also very closely tied to lifestyle. So it's misleading to think very strictly about ontogeny, meaning development, recapitulating phylogeny, meaning evolutionary history. We see bits and pieces of that, which are very fascinating, the little while we have a tail, or the features that we have that resemble those of our aquatic, distant aquatic ancestors. But it's not a strict recapitulation, so it's really something that we're urging not be taught.
Okay. Hey, Chris, thanks very much. An interesting question.
All right, thank you.
Okay. You know, that brings up the other question that I'm always perplexed by. So you've got this little ball of cells that begins to grow and starts to take on shape and form, and obviously switches are switching on and off. If the theory's right and there's this limited number of genes, so there's some switching going on, what makes the order work each time? I mean, it seems like so much has to happen absolutely correctly to get from a two-celled organism to an elephant,
well,
that you'd expect to have a lot of errors.
Yeah, a lot does have to work, right? But nature's been working on this for 600 million years, so and really worked out a lot of it in the first 100 million.
it's a smart learner, nature.
Yeah, nature's very good because it weeds out all the losers. So only those genomes that do this really well get to play in the next round.
Mm-hmm.
There is some variation, and without variation, there would be no evolution. So we know that the size and shape and color of characters that come out in various species do vary. We can see that among ourselves most easily. If you just look at human faces, you can see that cheek structure and eye color and all sorts of features of the head are different between us. Of course, we all belong to the human species. So all those differences are little variations in the process of development. So there is some tolerance in there. And the same sort of variation exists in other animal species. What natural selection plays with is that variation. And if some of that variation is more useful than others, that's going to be favored as the form of those species and its descendants evolve. So you're right that there's an awful lot of switches, an awful lot of toggles that have to be thrown in the right order and the right timing so that things don't collapse. But that is what natural selection is really good at, which is preserving everything that works and allowing a little bit of tolerance into things to enable some variation.
Hmm. Okay, well, we'll probably want to task you some more on that question, but I'm going to invite our listeners to join in the conversation. Our number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And let's take a number three here. Jock in Philadelphia, welcome to the program.
Hello. I would like to make a quick comment and ask Sean Carroll a question.
Go ahead.
The comment is, I want to thank you greatly for your wonderful book that I'm about halfway through. Because it is very understandable for someone not conversant with the field, and it's helping me understand what my daughter is doing, who recently changed her plans to go to medical school, and I learned 2 days ago has been accepted into the Evo Devo program at Washington University in St. Louis.
Well, there you go. So,
well, I want to point out that this is not a relative of mine making this call.
Okay.
That call.
No, it's a great book, and I commend it to anybody interested in science and particularly interested in informing themselves about the debate over evolution. The question I have is, using your science as a foundation, what do you predict will be possible in the way of translating this into clinical application in the practice of medicine in the future?
Okay, great question.
Like genomics and that field is emerging as a powerful new discipline looking ahead. Thank you very much.
Great question, Jock. Thanks. Quick answer?
Yeah, great question. It gives me a great opportunity to explain the intimate connection here between development and human medicine. And so understanding those genes that determine which cells are going to be of which types and how organs grow and the identity of organs, these are the genes that we're going to, for example, want to manipulate with stem cell technology. So I think that one of the things we're going to look forward to is greater expansion of our power to regenerate tissues, and this will all play into the role of transplantation to repair organ damage, to replace damaged cell types and things like that.
Sean Carroll, I need to interrupt to say we're talking with Sean Carroll about the new science of Evo Devo. I'm Joe Palca, and this is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Okay, let's take another call. Thanks for that answer. Let's go to Jeff in Jacksonville, Florida. Jeff, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you, Mr. Falca. Doctor, I've got a real quick question. I was a diver in the Navy, and one of the tenets was that everything in our body is driven by partial pressures of various chemistries within our blood. I just wanted to know if there's anything, and I've often thought that it would be similar to what triggers the development of genes and the expression of genes, is the partial pressures within each cell of the chemistry that's found in the amniotic fluid in a developing embryo.
Interesting.
Am I completely off base on that, or is that?
Well, development is going to run generally on different chemistry. It's really the chemistry of proteins interacting with DNA and of cells interacting with each other. So all the things you mentioned are physiologically important, but they don't drive the process of development per se.
Okay.
All right. Thanks very much for that. Let's take one more quick call and go to Rhonda in Des Moines, Iowa. Rhonda, go ahead. You're on the program.
Hello.
Hi.
I have always been intrigued that cloned animals aren't the same color or don't look like the animal they're cloned from. And I'm wondering if this has anything to do with that.
Huh. Interesting. Rhonda, thanks for that question. Sean Carroll?
Great question. You're speaking of cloned animals, Rhonda?
Yes.
So the major technique for cloning of animals is to take the nucleus out of a cell, of a typical body cell. Now, that nucleus has gotten to that body cell or gotten to that place through a long journey, originally descended from an egg. There are changes that are taking place through that process that may not be reversible. And so while cloned animals can be generated for some species from individual body cells, there have been some irreversible changes take place such that some of those body features don't come out the same way the next time around from the clone cell. That's why we see differences, for example, in body size. We see some metabolic differences. And some of the features determined by the sex of the animal are also variable. So it's a great question and a great observation, and if I can extend that, this is why the scientific community is uniformly against the cloning of humans.
Okay,
in
well,
any way, shape, or form, because of this tremendous risk that we don't understand about
Sean
the
Carroll,
identity of clones.
Sean Carroll, we have to take a short break. I'm Joe Palca, and this is This is from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Joe Palca. We're talking with Sean Carroll. He's the author of Endless Forms, Most Beautiful, The New Science of Evo Devo. He's also an investigator with the Howard Hughes Medical Institute and a professor of molecular biology, genetics, and medical genetics at the University of Wisconsin at Madison. And he's as his book title suggests, he's very involved in this new science of Evo Devo. And we have a lot of interesting callers, so let's take one more. Let's go to Leah in Mansfield, Minnesota. Did I get that right, Leah?
Mansfield, Massachusetts.
Ah, well, wrong state. Anyway, welcome to the program. What's your question?
My question is, if there are so many holes in the theory of evolution, and part of the previous theory was discarded, why don't we ask a question? Who created the whole mechanism to develop one species, not another? My second question is, who made the possibility to evolve in our genes?
Okay.
And my third question, the last one.
Okay.
If there are so many holes in uncertainty about evolution, why scientists don't, a very scientific question, and don't consider that possibility of creation by intelligent creation,
yeah,
and the possibility that the world was not created on a random, but by design?
Those are all interesting questions, and I think, Sean Carroll, I'm guessing you've thought about this quite a bit.
My credentials in theology are fairly thin, but let me go to the point about holes in the theory of evolution. I think it's really important to understand that as often as that phrase is repeated, there's not a lot of truth to it. The point being that for 150 years, biologists, geologists, scientists of all sorts of stripes have been testing and expanding upon Darwin's picture of evolution and seeing it in more rich detail as the decades pass, what we see at the level of the DNA record, what we see in embryos, what we see with new fossil discoveries, is entirely consistent and independent lines of evidence of the fundamental truth that life evolves by natural processes. In terms of the beginning of life, scientists really don't understand the beginning of life. We have some ideas, but there are many, many ideas, and they're all pretty much wide open to testing. In terms of design at a higher level, I think I'll pass on that one, because I think every citizen's entitled to conceive their own idea of that, and science is generally silent on that point.
Yeah. But, I mean, in your theory, isn't it tempting to say, okay, God made it work. Wasn't he so smart? He didn't reinvent the wheel for every different organism.
Well, you can certainly, you're entitled to that viewpoint. I think if you look at the scientific evidence, you understand that the process of genetic variation and natural selection is sufficient to account for all the changes in forms that we see through 3 billion years of life's history on Earth. And that the scientific community has no trouble understanding the connections between simple and complex, and that process of going from simple to complex is repeated every time an egg is fertilized. And we don't think that you need any miraculous intervention to create a human from a single fertilized egg. We know that it's biochemistry and it's cells and it's a lot of processes that are entirely observable and experimentally accessible. And so we don't reach for the supernatural when we think the natural is completely adequate.
Okay, let's take one more call and go to Charles in Boulder, Colorado. Charles, welcome to Science Friday.
Hi.
Hi.
I have a quick question.
Okay.
I wanted to know the impact of this research on the classification of new organisms and species and if that applies or not. And I'll take my answer off there. Thanks.
Okay, thanks.
So EvoDevo is allowing us to see some connections that we couldn't see before. And what it allows us to do, for example, is the tracing the origin of particular structures and sometimes identifying some connections that were concealed by outward appearances being so different. So it is starting to have an impact on how we understand the relationships between members of the animal kingdom, and it's allowing us to see very deeply into the stuff that makes animals similar or different. So it's going to have a contribution, and it's still a matter of time till we understand maybe what some of the most dramatic notions we overturn through this field are going to be.
All right. Well, we've run out of time for this segment. I'd like to thank my guest, Sean Carroll. He's an investigator with the Howard Hughes Medical Institute and a professor of molecular biology at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He's the author of Endless Forms Most Beautiful, The New Science of EvoDevo, published by W.W. Norton in 2005. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you, Joe.